Trump supporters say he's spending too much time on foreign policy and not enough on the economy. After this week's election results, are Republicans getting nervous? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. What do we know about how the economy is doing? I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Today is the second time during the federal shutdown that we won't get a government report about how many people are looking for work. Also, as Nancy Pelosi says she won't run for office again, we look back at her path to be the first woman Speaker of the House. It's Friday, November 7th. On this day in 1991, Magic Johnson retired from the NBA after testing positive for HIV. The next year, he would make a comeback by winning gold with the Dream Team at the Barcelona Summer Olympics. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The federal government shutdown is now the longest in U.S. history at 38 days. It's affecting air travel because air traffic controllers aren't getting paid and there are staffing shortages. Starting today, the federal government will begin reducing air traffic at dozens of airports. Airline traveler Reginald Dumas is in Dallas. He says he's preparing for chaos at the airport.
Continue to maybe adjust, you know, your times, your budgets, a lot of things like that, to try to stress things out. I don't think it's going to last that much longer because eventually I'm praying about it. It has to break.
By next week, up to 10% of flights will be reduced in the U.S. as the number of air traffic controllers continues to shrink. The shutdown is also affecting federal food assistance, known as SNAP. But a federal judge in Rhode Island has ordered the Trump administration to start paying full SNAP benefits starting today. But NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the Trump administration has already appealed.
Just last week, the same judge, John McConnell Jr., ordered the release of at least partial SNAP payments. A group of cities and nonprofits argued that was not enough and could take weeks for some states to administer. Judge McConnell agreed. He said the administration had ignored the harmful consequences of slashing the nation's biggest anti-hunger program. He also said President Trump showed intent to defy a court order when he posted on Truth Social this week that SNAP benefits would not restart until after the federal shutdown was over. The administration's appeal once again puts food aid on hold for millions of people as food banks around the country scramble to help fill the gap. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Supreme Court will let President Trump require people applying for passports list their sex at birth. No accommodation will be provided for people who are transgender. For now, the decision overturns a lower court ruling, as NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Trump plan overturns policies adopted by six previous administrations, including his own first term, that allowed what the plaintiffs say was their ability to list on their passports what they refer to as their apparent transgender identity instead of their sex at birth. But in the second administration, Trump reversed course, allowing only the designation of a person's sex at birth. Transgender passport applicants went to court, contending the new rule amounted to unconstitutional sex discrimination. A lower court agreed, but yesterday the Supreme Court, bowing to the Trump administration's appeal, allowed the new Trump plan to be put in place for now. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump is to welcome Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán to the White House today. The two leaders are expected to review potential sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine. This is NPR. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military has attacked another boat in the Caribbean, and three people were killed. Writing online last night, Hegseth alleged the boat was involved in drug trafficking. He has offered no evidence of his claim. The Congressional Budget Office says it's been hacked. It's possible saboteurs could have accessed important government information. A spokeswoman says the CBO identified the security incident and has taken immediate action to contain it. The CBO offers nonpartisan analysis to congressional lawmakers during the budget process. Just in time for the holiday rush, a few new records are making their way onto the Billboard charts. NPR's Stephen Thompson has more.
This week, three new records debut in the top 10 of the Billboard Albums chart, including the first ever top 10 hit from rising R&B singer Daniel Caesar. Son of Spurgy debuts at number 4.
I can call on me.
Brandi Carlile hits the top 10 for a fifth time as Returning to Myself debuts at number 7.
And returning to myself is such a lonely thing to do.
And pop star Demi Lovato's ninth studio album is also her ninth top 10 hit. It's Not That Deep debuts at number 9. None of them could displace the season's biggest hit. Taylor Swift's The Life of a Showgirl holds at number 1 for a fourth straight week. Stephen Thompson, NPR News.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Bruce Springsteen may have been nicknamed the Boss, but his record label was calling the shots. They wanted the New Jersey rocker to make a music video to promote his new album, Born in the USA. The Boss didn't see what videos had to do with making music, but this was 1984, the heyday of MTV, 24-hour music television. So that's why The Boss took a film crew with him to Minnesota in June 1984 for the start of his tour. For 2 days, they recorded him running through one of his songs on stage at the St. Paul Civic Center. Each time, Bruce would yank a fan out of the audience and dance with her. The fan was actually actor Courtney Cox, who would later find fame on the TV series Friends. As far as music videos went, the one filmed in Minnesota was pretty basic, but it would help make his song, Dancing in the Dark, the biggest of Bruce Springsteen's career.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump is hosting Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary at the White House. Last night, he had dinner with Central Asian leaders and expanded the Abraham Accords. Earlier, he threatened strikes against Nigeria.
This on the same week that the government shutdown became the longest ever, and election results suggest Trump's edge on the economy is waning. It's raising concerns among some of Trump's allies that he's spending too much time focused on the rest of the world and not enough at home.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez joins us now. So what's this meeting with Orban about?
Yeah, I mean, the meeting is expected to be about the war in Ukraine and pressing Hungary to stop buying Russian oil as a means to pressure Moscow to end the war. Though the concern is not about Orban specifically, but all the time and effort put on foreign policy. I mean, A, it's not just 1 week. In the past month, Trump's helped broker a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. He continues to threaten Venezuela. He's trekked across Asia, struck a deal with China, and even started to plan a meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It's just a tremendous amount of foreign policy work.
And then the timing, too, because right now many Americans are struggling with the cost of living. I mean, so some of Trump allies feel like he really needs to be talking more about the economy instead.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just about the election results either, but also Trump's low approval ratings. Stephen Bannon told Politico that Trump shouldn't spend so much time on the Middle East and Ukraine and needs to pivot to the economy. Vivek Ramaswamy, a candidate for Ohio governor, said Republicans can't mess around.
Our side needs to focus on affordability. Make the American dream affordable. Bring down costs, electric costs, grocery costs, healthcare costs and housing costs, and lay out how we're going to do it.
And J.D. Vance, the vice president, while downplaying the Democrats' victories, also said Republicans need to, quote, focus on the home front.
So people close to the president are asking for a pivot. Will he?
I mean, he's talking a lot about the economy now, but he's largely blaming allies in Congress, Republicans, for not touting his work.
The affordability is much better with the Republicans. The only problem is the Republicans don't talk about it. And Republicans should start talking about it and use their heads.
Yeah, and the White House told me that there will be more of a focus on the home front and cited yesterday's announcement on lowering drug prices. But they push back on the idea that his work overseas isn't in U.S. interests, saying new trade deals, for example, brings money home and killing drug traffickers keeps Americans safer.
Do you think, Franco, that all of this might be an issue for the midterms? They're coming up in less than a year.
It probably will. I mean, I was talking with John McHenry, a Republican pollster, who said the economy is always going to be the most important issue for voters.
People expect you to do well on foreign policy, but they expect you to do well on foreign policy while you're also laser focused on domestic issues. You know, the foreign policy is a kind of a nice to have, and the domestic policy is a must have.
Franco, are Republicans nervous?
Yeah, I mean, McHenry also pointed to an NBC poll that shows 2/3 of Americans feel Trump has fallen short on the economy, which were similar numbers that former President Barack Obama had in 2010. And that year, Obama's party lost 63 House seats in the midterm elections.
All right, that's NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A, and happy birthday.
For more on Trump's messaging on the economy, we're joined by Republican strategist Brendan Buck. He's a partner at the consulting firm Seven Letter. Before that, he served as press secretary to House Speaker John Boehner and later advised House Speaker Paul Ryan. And we'll note he's working now on a coalition that's trying to get Affordable Care Act tax credits extended. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Hi, Layla.
So I want to start with what we just heard. There are voters sending a message this week that President Trump is not delivering on promises of affordability.
It's hard to argue otherwise. As the pollster just said, yeah, the economy is always number one. I think what's interesting about this is Donald Trump has had bad numbers for quite a while, and we just haven't had any event that really forced anyone to confront that. And I think that's what happened here. In some ways, our politics are really complicated. In some ways, they're pretty simple. Our voters tend to swing back and forth. When they have an incumbent who they don't think is getting the job done, they're going to send a message to them at the polls. I think that's what happened Tuesday, and it is absolutely a wake-up call that should be for Republicans and certainly the president, who seems to want to distance himself from it. But this is very squarely, I think, on Donald Trump, and his numbers were reflected in what happened this week.
Let me ask you about that, because we heard the president there say it's a messaging problem. So is it a messaging problem, or is it about what is being done or not being done?
Well, I think it can be both. I mean, ironically, he's starting to sound a little bit like Joe Biden, which is don't believe your own finances. Believe me when I tell you everything is fine. And that's a really hard sell. And he's not the first president to try to do that. But if you're not actually lowering people's prices or at least holding them down, eventually that's going to catch up to you. You can only tell people something so long before their own reality disputes it. Now, there are potentially ways to address this substantively, and we just had a Supreme Court hearing this week. Maybe that can be an off-ramp. If these tariffs that he's been putting in place get struck down, maybe he can back away from that and do something to tangibly lower prices, because I think ultimately what the economy is doing is going to be much more important than what he says about it.
Let me ask, though, you know, we heard from the administration that, you know, it's being overblown. That stuff is being taken. There's too much being taken from Tuesday's vote. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would say that there's still a long time until the election, but I think that there are really clear warning signs. And look, you have to tend to your politics a little more than I think the administration and Republicans broadly have been doing. Look, if you have an election in Virginia and you've just fired a bunch of federal workers, that's going to show up. But if you cancel an important tunnel project in New Jersey and you have an election there, that's going to show up. If you've made gains with Hispanic voters, but then you run an administration that's rounding people up in communities and terrorizing communities, that's going to show up. And to date, they've acted pretty cavalier with some of their policies and the political impact of them. So hopefully this could be a bit of a reset where they're thinking a little more strategically about what they're doing substantively.
So if you were advising, what would you say to do in this moment, given what happened on Tuesday?
Well, certainly right to focus on the economy rhetorically, but I think you also need to focus on it substantively. I mean, you mentioned that I'm working on these ACA tax credits. I mean, that is a huge issue. Next year, either people's healthcare premiums are going to go up a little bit, or they're going to go up a lot. And that's a decision that Congress is going to have to face. I think that's one tangible thing that they can do. Again, the tariffs are something very tangible they can do. But some of it is just sort of getting out of the bubble. I mean, too often Republicans are only worried about whether their sort of conservative base is comfortable with what they're doing. And I think what we found on Tuesday is there's a whole world out there outside of your conservative base. And if you are not focused on those bread and butter issues, they're going to punish you. So it really requires you to think about those sort of middle class, down the middle, independent voters who really still, even as polarized as we are, determine most outcomes.
So are you saying they should sit down with the Democrats, figure out health care, and get the government open?
Well, that would be a good start for sure. I mean, the government shutdown is not serving anyone's interest at this point. I don't think it's working for Democrats. I don't think it's working for Republicans. And it really does this make everybody sour on Washington. And when you're the party in power, it doesn't do you very good to have everybody kind of just disgusted with what's going on. You're going to be the ones punished. And that's not a new dynamic. The party in power almost always has a bad first midterm election. And so Republicans are working against history. They're working against now the economy, which the Democrats have sort of taken that issue away from them. So they got a lot of work to do. And hopefully, you know, as a Republican, we can figure that out and focus a little more on the things that people care about.
That's Republican strategist Brendan Buck. Thank you so much for your time and your insights.
Of course. Thank you.
Okay, the verdict is in a case involving a sub sandwich. A jury in Washington, D.C. found Sean Charles Dunn not guilty of assault for throwing a hoagie at a federal agent. The case came to symbolize how parts of the city responded to President Trump's law enforcement surge. Here's NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson.
Sean Charles Dunn embraced his lawyers as the jury foreman read the not guilty verdict. The jury rejected a misdemeanor assault charge against Dunn for throwing a foot-long sub sandwich at a Customs and Border Protection agent in August. Dunn says he's relieved and wants to move forward with his life.
And I am so happy that justice prevails.
Dunn's an Air Force veteran who worked at the Justice Department. Attorney General Pam Bondi fired him after a video of the sandwich incident went viral. On the video, Dunn called officers patrolling the city as part of President Trump's safe and beautiful D.C. order fascists and racist. Dunn thought they were about to raid a gay nightclub on Latin night.
Every life matters, no matter where you came from, no matter how you got here, no matter how you identify.
Prosecutors initially tried to charge Dunn with a felony, but a grand jury refused to indict him. Instead, DOJ pursued a less serious misdemeanor count, arguing that Dunn had forcibly assaulted, resisted, or impeded the federal agent. Prosecutors say Dunn went too far, that you can't throw things, especially at law enforcement. Agent Gregory Larimore testified the sandwich exploded on his bulletproof vest. He said mustard got on his uniform and onion on his radio. But defense lawyers pointed out the agent kept gag gifts about the incident in his office, a plush toy and a patch that says felony footlong. Sabrina Schroff told the jury to use common sense. This was not a weapon hurled with force anywhere near justifying federal charges. Outside the courthouse, Schroff beamed at the crowd.
We really want to thank the jury for having sent back an affirmation that dissent is what is not just tolerated, it is legal, it is welcome.
Dunn wore a pink shirt and shorts on the night of the incident. Some jurors seemed to notice. This week, two jurors donned bright pink sweaters. Another looked at the defense table and pumped her fists at her sides after the verdict was read. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
NPR News.
Heidi Holton. We're excited at KEXE to be bringing you more jazz programming with our volunteer, Paul Kivi, the history of jazz.
Well, I think this is some of the finest music ever made, and it's kind of gotten lost across time. I pick the songs that I love, and there's lots of them, and there's lots to love. The popular music in the late 20s and 30s, especially the 30s and 40s with the big band era, that was jazz. That was the one period of time when jazz was popular music. And so you're going to hear a lot of things that are easy to get into. If you develop a taste for it, then the stuff that happens starting with Charlie Parker in the late 1940s makes sense.
Hear the history of jazz on KAXE with Paul Kivi, Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Martinez. It's the first Friday of the month, which normally means we'd be talking about a new government jobs report. But for the second month in a row, that report's been held up by the government shutdown. So that means economists have to look elsewhere for clues about hiring and firing in the economy. But luckily for us, NPR has its own jobs detective, Scott Horsley, who is on the case. Scott, okay, so we didn't get a September report on unemployment. Now we're missing the October report. How much are economists feeling in the dark?
Well, good morning. It's kind of like what happened after we set the clocks back. You know, it's a lot darker at 6 p.m. now than it was a couple months ago, and there's definitely less visibility. The last official jobs report we got was 2 months ago, and as Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook told an audience at the Brookings Institution this week, that's a long time in a fast-moving economy like ours.
I'm worried about the labor market because it can turn very quickly. It can deteriorate very quickly.
That's why the Fed lowered interest rates last week in an effort to boost demand and try to prop up the job market. Cook did say even without the official jobs data, she and her colleagues are not flying blind. There are various private sector indicators they can look at. Of course, they're talking to their business contacts. And all those other clues are getting extra attention in the absence of the government jobs report.
All right, so what do those clues tell us about the job market?
Well, it's kind of a mixed picture. There was some ominous news yesterday when a firm that keeps tabs on pink slips, Challenger Gray & Christmas, put out a report saying it was the worst October for layoff announcements in more than two decades. Of course, high-profile firms like Amazon and UPS have been announcing job cuts in recent weeks. So far, though, we have not seen a big jump in the number of people filing for unemployment benefits. So it's not really clear if there are actually a lot more layoffs now or they're just getting more attention than usual. On the flip side, ADP, which is a payroll processing company, just reported stronger job growth in October than in August or September. But, you know, ADP's numbers often don't match up very well with the government figures, so analysts have to take that with a grain of salt.
All right, so well, how are those analysts feeling about the job market in general?
Well, you know, surveys suggest regular people are kind of gloomy about the job market. The Conference Board found that a growing number of people are now saying jobs are harder to get. The job search website Glassdoor also found employees feeling less confident. They're more likely to take the first job that comes along rather than waiting to see if there's something better in the pipeline. That's not terribly surprising given all the headlines about layoffs and the government shutdown. In that last official report we got for the month of August, the unemployment rate was still quite low, just 4.3%. But Lisa Cook cautioned in her Brookings speech that unemployment is significantly higher among young people and African-American workers, who are often the first to feel it when there's a downturn.
This is sometimes called a two-speed economy, when the well-off are doing well and vulnerable households are not.
By the way, Cook's own job is on the line. President Trump has tried to fire her from the Federal Reserve over unproven allegations of mortgage fraud. So far, that dismissal has been blocked by the Supreme Court, and the High Court is going to take up Cook's case early next year.
That is NPR's jobs detective, Scott Horsley. Scott, thanks.
Good to be with you.
Time now for StoryCorps. Shanita Baraka Akintondo Day and Danielle Tavon Bishop are sisters who grew up in Chicago in the 80s. They came to StoryCorps to remember their mother, Mary Catherine Bishop, known to family and friends as Cat.
She was born in Brinkley, Arkansas, which I call Blinkley because if you blink, you'd miss it. She had dark ebony skin, bright brown eyes, and white teeth. She painted her nails dark maroons, and her lipstick matched that. And I remember when she kissed me.
It left the lipstick print on you.
Yeah, it left that lipstick print. I loved it. Mom didn't give two flying hoots whether you agreed with her. She was going to say what she wanted to say. And if you got with it, great. If you didn't, peace. She would tell you the same story.
But a different spin on it.
But it would be a different spin every time. And you did not interrupt her and say, Mom, I've heard that story before, right?
Absolutely not.
I'd literally studied everything from how she walked to how she talked because I thought she was amazing.
The year before her passing, it was Thanksgiving, and she took me in the kitchen. She told me specifically, this is my last year cooking, so you need to learn how to do this. And I remember we stayed up to the early morning, laughing, having a good time, and that was our last Thanksgiving.
On her last days, she was in the hospital at this point, going in and out of consciousness. She said, take me home and make my room look like heaven. So what we did was paint the walls a beautiful mauve color, like a sunset. We made sure with the pillows that they were fluffed properly and that the sheets popped. When she came home, she looked around and smiled. I just wanted to savor that moment because I knew that meant she was happy with what we had done. She told us to get her two things.
Two drinks.
Mm-hmm.
The sherry and the beer. In a bottle.
Not a can.
Not a can.
And I said, you can't have that. You're on medication.
And remember the look she gave you.
She gave me the look. And I said, I'll be right back. I don't even know if she swallowed it. She just brought it up to her lips. And that night she passed.
The next year, that was my first Thanksgiving. And all of the family came over to my home. And I tried to channel all that I could of my mom. And now I feel like her hands come on top of me as I'm preparing the meals.
You know, Mom, she was my first real role model. And I think I'm still evolving into being half the woman she was.
That's Shanita Baraka Akintande and Danielle Tavon Bishop. Their mother, Mary Catherine Bishop, died in 2012. Their conversation is part of the StoryCorps Brightness is in Black project. It's archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, featuring the 2026 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at subaru.com/wilderness. And from Dignity Memorial, for many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
Global pop star Rosalia is back with a new album, and it's her most ambitious yet, featuring 13 different languages.
I love people realizing that pop music can be great art, and that's something that's happening here.
I'm Juana Summers. NPR's Stephen Thompson reviews Rosalia's sprawling new record, Lux. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon with your local host, Andrew Dizingle. Good morning. It is 5:29. Thanks for listening to the Friday Morning Show. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date, November 7th. Mostly cloudy today, highs in the mid to upper 30s with northwest winds 10 to 20. Temps falling tonight to 16 to 23 degrees. And for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 30s with north winds up to 20 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Sunday, partly sunny, highs near 30 with blustery north wind. Minnesota's firearm deer season opens tomorrow. For our question of the week, we're wondering about your hunting traditions or if you have stories to share. You can text in 218-326-1234. The KAXC News team has put together a list of food-related resources across northern Minnesota. You'll find hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Visit KAXC.org to find that list, and if you have something to add, email news@KAXC.org. Pine River Market Square has their last market of the year tomorrow from 10 to 2 indoors at the warehouse located on Norway Avenue. Find local produce, baked goods, crafts, and more. And the Itasca Ski and Outing Club has a grand opening for its new Minnesota Ski Jumping Museum. That is tomorrow from noon to 4 at Mount Itasca near Coleraine. See historic artifacts and learn about local champions and Olympians. The next Bemidji Contra Dance is tomorrow evening at Susie and Hondo Dance Studio. A potluck dinner starts at 5:30. Dancing follows at 6:30. No experience or partners needed. Everything will be taught by a caller while you dance to live music from the O'Neill Family Band. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, November 7th, 2001, the pine grosbeaks return to northern Minnesota. Usually about this time of year, the beautiful red male pine grosbeaks and their partners, the female pine grosbeaks that are mostly gray with a little touch of orange on the rump and maybe the back of the head, return to northern Minnesota to enjoy the balmy Minnesota weather as they await spring and their return trip to the north. These birds are among my favorites when it comes to wintertime birds because they come readily to the feeder, though they prefer a feeder without a cover. If your feeder has a roof on it, try putting seeds on the ground or try putting seeds on a flat board somewhere, and you'll find that the pine grosbeaks are much more readily adapted to that. For some reason, they don't like a roof over their heads. They are beautiful, and they have a beautiful, clear, melodic song that they sing in the wintertime, so they are most welcome as we dive into our cold season.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
Edamé Martinez in Los Angeles, California. Nancy Pelosi will not run for re-election. In 2007, she claimed a title no woman had won before, Speaker of the House. Here she is on C-SPAN.
And today I thank my colleagues. By electing me Speaker, you have brought us closer to the ideal of equality that is America's heritage and America's hope.
Over 38 years in Congress, Pelosi fought for civil rights and health care. She fought against guns and AIDS. California Governor Gavin Newsom told KQED's Political Breakdown last month that Pelosi's impact cannot be overstated.
No one, period, full stop, has delivered more for San Francisco, the state of California, than Nancy Pelosi, period.
For more, we're joined now by journalist Molly Ball, who wrote the biography, Pelosi. Molly, I mean, Pelosi's path to Congress was not necessarily a traditional one. Why was her first election to Congress such a notable change for her?
Well, she was already 47 years old. She had been a housewife and political volunteer for her entire life up to that point. So while she was active in Democratic politics, she wasn't someone who'd set out to run for office. It only came about because her friend who held that San Francisco political seat, Sala Burton, was dying of cancer. And in a scene so cinematic, you sort of can't make it up. She extracted a deathbed promise from her friend Nancy Pelosi to run for the seat in Congress after she passed. So this was not something that Pelosi set out to do. It was something of a second career for her when she became an empty nester. But of course, she ended up being historically successful at it.
47 years old. I think people forget that, right? Because people are elected so young nowadays that 47 back then was kind of a older age to start.
Absolutely. I mean, she certainly was not part of any youth quake, but she brought to the job a lot of contacts, a lot of credentials. She had been a volunteer and political operative in California. She helped bring the 1984 Democratic Convention to San Francisco. She even ran for chair of the Democratic National Committee. So she was pretty well known as a Democratic operative, but she didn't ever see herself actually being in the arena until fate made that a possibility.
What was it like to be a congresswoman in the late 80s, like when Nancy Pelosi entered Congress?
I'm so glad you asked that, because it's so easy to forget how different things were for women in politics just 40 years ago. There were only 25 other women members of the entire House and Senate, 535 members at the time that Nancy Pelosi got there in 1987. There was no women's bathroom near the House floor. Women were not allowed to wear pants on the floor of the Senate. and many of the women who were there were the widows of congressmen who had died and whose wives had taken their place. So the idea that a woman could not only be a member of Congress, but a leader in Congress was unthinkable. And indeed, no woman had become either the House Whip or a House Party leader before Nancy Pelosi achieved those milestones in 2001 and 2003, before, of course, becoming the first woman Speaker.
Molly, what would you say are her biggest legislative achievements?
She would always tell you the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is the thing that she is proudest of. And she moved heaven and earth to get that legislation through the House under very difficult circumstances when Barack Obama was president. She was also Obama's partner on his other legislative achievements, the stimulus bill, Wall Street reform. She worked on issues such as allowing gays to serve openly in the military. When Biden was president, she helped him pass his massive social spending and climate spending and infrastructure bills. And even when George W. Bush was president during his first speakership, she opposed him on most things, but she also worked with him to pass the financial bailout that they saw as rescuing the economy during the 2008 crash.
Just about a few seconds left, Molly. I mean, why do you think she decided to make this, of all the terms, her last term?
Well, she's 85 years old. It's not a question we usually ask of 85-year-olds when they decide to retire. Why do it now?
Yeah.
But, you know, she was instrumental in convincing Joe Biden to exit the presidential race last year. She also saw the decline of her colleague in the California delegation, Dianne Feinstein. You have to imagine, although I haven't spoken to her about this, that those examples were on her mind, and she wanted to leave gracefully on her own terms, not seeming to be pushed out by anyone, having all of her faculties intact and being able to take a sort of victory lap and leave on a high note with the gratitude of a generation of Democrats.
Molly Ball is a political journalist and the author of the biography Pelosi. Molly, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted on social media late last night that the U.S. military destroyed another boat in the Caribbean. It's the latest strike against boats the administration says were carrying drugs. More than 60 people have been killed in all of these attacks. The post came just hours after the Senate failed to pass a measure that would have stopped President Trump from waging war with Venezuela. The vote was 49 to 51 and was a test of how far Republicans will go to push back on Trump. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales has more.
As President Trump directs an escalating conflict in and around Venezuela, concerns among lawmakers are growing too.
The executive branch does not have the authority to kill at will anyone, anywhere, at any time, for any reason.
That's Kentucky Republican Rand Paul on the floor of the GOP-led Senate fighting for a war powers resolution to stop the escalation. Paul argues the current military tempo signals the Trump administration's interest in a regime change to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. So Paul sponsored the resolution with Democrats, including Virginia Senator Tim Kaine.
You don't need a Ford-class carrier to interdict small drug boats.
That's Kaine on the Senate floor on Thursday. Ultimately, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski was the only other Republican to join Paul, though GOP members like Indiana Senator Todd Young warned they're troubled by aspects of the strikes. Trump supporters like South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham say in modern history, Congress has typically not intervened when presidents initiated conflicts.
The day that we terminate a military operation based on the idea that we haven't authorized it, then we become commander-in-chief.
Graham said presidents have started dozens of conflicts while Congress has only declared five wars. And he says there's good reason for presidents to act.
535 people have a hard time deciding when to go to lunch.
But critics say this military buildup is different. Trump cabinet officials briefed a bipartisan group of congressional leaders this week. Even after the briefings, critics say they don't have the identities of those killed or evidence justifying the strikes, which many argue is illegal. Here's Paul.
I would advise President Trump to remember the wise words of his inaugural address. We will measure our success by the wars we never get into.
The issue will not disappear after the failed boat. Trump recently ordered the country's largest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald R. Ford, and its strike group to the waters off South America. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
This is NPR News.
KEXE was first on the air in 1976. Recently, a couple of the founders, Rich and Susie McClear, stopped by to talk about why KEXE was needed then.
A lot of people were up here thinking they were doing their own thing. And when the radio station came on the air, they found a neighbor was doing the same thing, or somebody across town. And it magically became there are a lot of us up here that have the same thoughts, the same activities.
Neighbors talking to neighbors. We help them get in contact with each other and talk to each other about common problems.
KEXE is still needed now. We're connected through green cheese trivia, through great music and events. We're in crisis mode. We have had all of our funding cut from the federal government. Please help us out. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton. Thank you so much for your support.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
It's 542. Thanks for listening to the Friday Morning Show on People Powered, KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. I'll be joining Heidi Holton today, filling in for John Bauer. Coming up about 1 hour from now, our talkback segment will let you know what we've heard from our listeners this week. We always love to hear from you. Text in your thoughts about anything you hear, 218-326-1234. Mostly cloudy today, highs 35 to 38, winds from the northwest 10 to 20. Temperatures falling this evening to 16 to 23. For tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the low 30s and north winds up to 20 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night in the upper teens, and for Sunday, partly sunny with highs near 30, blustery north winds. And looking ahead to Monday, partly sunny, highs in the low to mid 30s. The Crossing Arts Alliance hosts the Sweet Life Poetry Reading tomorrow from 1 to 3 at the Central Lakes College Library in Brainerd. The winners from Lake Country Journal's Poetry Contest will read their poems, along with several other entrants, and light refreshments will be served.
The classic movie series continues at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork Thursday, November 13th. This month's film is Rio Bravo, starring John Wayne, Dean Martin, and Ricky Nelson. The movie starts at 6:30. It's free and open to everyone. Let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org.
For NPR comes from this station. And from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide this enrollment period and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil.
And I'm A. Martinez. The Trump administration is appealing a judge's ruling that SNAP food benefits must be fully funded this month. But regardless of the outcome in that case, when the shutdown ends, changes are coming behind the scenes to the USDA program. Here's Nick Fountain from NPR's Planet Money.
Nate Singer, director of the Oregon Eligibility Partnership, is the type of bureaucrat's bureaucrat who basically always carries around a pen and a highlighter in case he needs to mark up a document.
My kids think that I have my own coloring books that are just really boring coloring books.
Even on weekends, even on holidays. Take this 4th of July. Singer was at a barbecue, and whenever he could get a break from the grill, he was marking up the text of the big budget bill, which President Trump was signing that day, and which contained big cuts to a program Singer oversees, food stamps, or SNAP. And what he saw was the bill cuts who qualifies for the program, how much they get, and maybe most importantly for him, who pays for the program. This is a fundamental shift. For the entire history of food stamps, the federal government has paid for all of the benefits that go out. But what Singer saw, highlighter in one hand and greasy spatula in the other, was that this bill shifts that. Now, many states are going to have to pay for a portion of food stamp funds. How much? Well, the bill ties that amount to an obscure stat called the payment error rate, which is a measure of how accurately states, which administer food stamp programs, are giving out federal taxpayer dollars.
Did we process it right, and did you get the right benefit amount?
The payment error rate captures when states give too much and too little. And pretty soon, the worse their error rate, the more they're going to have to pay. If Oregon stays where they're at, they'll be on the hook for some $250 million a year. Which is a problem for Singer in particular, because it's his job to get it down.
Are you up for this challenge?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So how is he going to get the error rate down? Well, training for the state workers who sign people up, technological improvements, but those tweaks will only go so far. So Singer's been calling around, asking states with low error rates, how are you doing it? He says a lot of them do something Oregon's been trying to avoid, asking for more documentation. Receipts for things like rent or utilities, which, yes, makes things more accurate, but also leads to less people signing up, even if they qualify and are hungry. He says changes like that, they are above his pay grade. They're more on the level of this person.
Governor, can you hear me?
I can hear you. How's my sense?
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek says they are not going to make it harder for people to sign up. Not now, which means they might have to start paying up. Do they have the money?
There is not $250 million just sitting on a shelf somewhere to backfill this reduction that the federal government says we need to take.
So I think the federal government's like moral justification behind tying this error rate to what states have to pay is that states administer this program and they should care about waste, fraud, and abuse. Do you think that's legitimate, trying to tie those two things?
I think we all want to minimize waste, fraud, and abuse. The idea that the error rate is such a good signifier of that is faulty.
The White House and USDA did not respond to requests for comment. Bottom line, Kotek says they're going to try to keep people on the program, a program that's never going to be the same. Nick Fountain, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadil.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know who listen to this, Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations, we really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local, and given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
Awful. It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
Let's do the numbers on flights, with the FAA ordering up some cancellations today at 40 airports.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Wealth Enhancement, providing its Wealth Blueprint, a plan that integrates retirement, investing, taxes, and estate planning into one plan. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/blueprint. And by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. The Transportation Department is, as of now, phasing in flight cancellations to ease strain on the air traffic system. This amid staff shortages caused by no pay for controllers, with the government still shut down. Looking at FlightAware's running tally, cancellations at Chicago O'Hare, Newark Liberty, Atlanta Hartsfield, Denver, Dallas, LAX, and San Francisco are all running cancellations so far at 3% as dawn breaks in the east. Phoenix Sky Harbor shows 4% cancellations. The goal is 4% today, rising to 10% by late next week if the government stays closed. Here's Marketplace's Nova Safo.
Airlines have a scheduling mess on their hands, and an unprecedented one, says Ahmed Abdelghani of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
It's multiple airlines, multiple airports.
Unlike, say, a storm or a computer outage, this time all carriers across the country have to adjust.
Eventually, airlines will not be able to fly some of their flights, and eventually they have to refund passengers because passengers will not be able to travel in some markets.
Indications are that airlines are focusing on trimming shorter regional routes first, and Rebecca Hupp, director of the airport in Boise, Idaho, is preparing.
Many of the airports that we have connections to are on the list, but our hope would be that people are aware of potential flight changes before they get to the airport.
Some travelers might opt for ground transportation instead, or might cancel their plans altogether.
It will obviously mean lower revenue for airlines.
Neville Taneja, professor emeritus at Ohio State University, is a longtime airline industry advisor. He says airlines might try to make up for that lost business by charging more on other routes where they can.
As far as the consumers are concerned, yes, the prices are likely to go up.
So pain ahead for both passengers and airlines. How much pain? Depends on how long the disruptions last. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Let's do the numbers. Sounds like down. Yes, indeed. Futures are pointing down. -0.4% for S&P futures. NASDAQ futures are down 0.5%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering small business owners protection for what they've worked hard to build with over 30 customizable coverages. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And by Yubico, makers of the YubiKey. YubiKey helps protect important digital applications and services. YubiKey, still undefeated, the original passkey. More at yubico.com.
It was an enduring workplace tradition. When the manager gets tense, they declare a little emergency and expect you to snap to attention regardless of time, day, or what you're doing at the moment. That's why they are the boss of you. But we're picking up a shift in the wind on these common declarations of workplace red alerts. The Washington Post had a piece the other day suggesting Gen Z workers may not be so ready to pull U-turns if a hyperventilating memo arrives. In such matters, it's good to bring in Adam Grant, an organizational psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. He's also host of the podcast Rethinking. Adam, welcome back.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
Do you see a pushback to this need to respond to whatever's deemed an emergency?
I do. I'm hearing this consistently from my students at Wharton, and it's something I've been seeing in a lot of workplaces. People saying, look, your emergency isn't necessarily my problem, especially if it's not in my job description.
Oh, especially if it's not in my job description. Waiving the job description. That used to be a fatal career move back when I was a lad.
Deadly back in the day. And, you know, now it's a question of who has power. Is it employers? In a world where it's increasingly difficult to find a job? Or is it employees who can embarrass you on social media?
How does a grown-up thinking about good management think about both declaring workplace emergencies if you're a manager and responding to commands marked urgent with all these exclamation points? Like, what's best practice?
Look, David, my first advice to leaders and managers is just take a step back and ask, what are the problems that could have a severe and lasting impact on our workplace if they're not addressed immediately? And if I know what those are, it's a lot easier to save urgent emergency for when there actually is something of consequence. I think in the moment then, the next thing you do is you let people know not just that the issue needs to be handled, but also why it's important. And I think if you just stop to take the time to explain, hey, this is why this is an urgent issue, you find that people are much more reasonable in response.
I remember exactly where I saw this and when. It was 1986 in the newsroom of Channel 5 TV in San Francisco. A news editor had a printed sign above his edit station in bold. Notice, lack of planning on your part does not constitute an automatic emergency on my part. That's nearly 40 years ago. People have been resentful of people reaching in and overturning your work day for a very long time.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think one of the things that we ought to be doing is being a little bit clearer about what the expected time frame is for a response. So your urgent, all hands on deck now message is a lot more legitimate. If your other emails say, no rush on this, would be great to hear back from you by the end of the week, or would be very helpful to get an answer in 48 hours. And if we were just a little bit clearer about our expectations, I think when we really need people to step up, they would be more willing to do it.
Adam Grant at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. His latest book is entitled Hidden Potential, The Science of Achieving Greater Things. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, David.
Dear listener, I know you're out there. What is your view on snapping to attention whenever the red alert sounder hits at work? We want to hear your stories and views, bosses, minions, everyone in between. I say minions with affection and respect. There's a place to share your stories on our main page. Go to marketplace.org and you should see it. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. It's the Marketplace Morning Report. You're from APM, American Public Media.
It's a minute before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. We have lots of local news stories and conversations there, as well as a list of food-related resources throughout our community. Mostly cloudy today, highs 35 to 38, winds from the northwest 10 to 20. Temperatures tonight 16 to 23. For tomorrow, partly sunny, highs 30 to 33. Winds from the north gusting up to 20 miles per hour. For Saturday night, lows in the upper teens. And for Sunday, partly sunny with highs near 30. You can make a reservation to be our guest on What's for Breakfast, and that's coming up at 7:45 this morning. Text us 218-326-1234.
Good morning. Airlines are